there's an, I would recommend an article in the February issue of Encounter by someone with a very Dutch name on the subject of the official Russia and unofficial Russia. He makes the point that, along the same lines Professor Nutter was saying, that official Russia hasn't changed at all. You go to Russia and everything looks exactly the same. He said that in the past 30 years, every society has outwardly has drastically changed, except in Russia. The buildings look the same, the enemies are the same, the friends are the same, the editorials in Pravda are the same, the shoddy merchandise is the same. But, he said, underneath all this, there's been a great change. He makes the point that there are probably more convinced Marxists in, say, the University of Paris or in any Western university than in all of the Soviet universities put together. He said, you'll never find a convinced Marxist, really, in Russia. Well, anyway, we have two what are they called? Discussants. Yes. The first is Edward E. Erickson, Dean of Academic Affairs and Professor of English at Northwestern College in Orange City, Iowa, who wrote a very good article, I remember now, in Modern Age some year or two ago on Solzhenitsyn and the various underground writers. And he will comment on Professor Niemeyer's paper and Paul Craig Roberts, Professor of Economics at West Georgia College, Research Fellow, Hoover Institution, Stanford, will comment on Professor Nutter's paper. Well, first of all, Mr. Erickson.
For those of you who don't know it, Professor Niemeyer added a coda to his original paper, which gives me great difficulty because it robs me of most of what little thunder I had. And you will see as I go through a few remarks that I have written down that we share great areas of common understanding and interest in our approach to Solzhenitsyn. As an unabashed hero worshiper of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, one of my recurring nightmares is to witness the cultural vultures of American graduate schools descending on the corpus of Solzhenitsyn, picking away at pieces of it out of an appreciation of its economic value for producing advanced degrees and academic sinecures. The day of the Solzhenitsyn specialist will soon be upon Slavic departments everywhere with dissecting, trivializing, and deadening effects, I fear. Professor Niemeyer is no Solzhenitsyn specialist. Rather, he is, in the best sense of a term much maligned in academic circles, a Solzhenitsyn amateur. And the etymology of amateur, I remind you, is lover, one who loves. One of my friends here present asked me last night how it felt to have discovered Solzhenitsyn before that was the popular thing to do. The question could have as easily been put to Professor Niemeyer, and since his and my public pronouncements on Solzhenitsyn are so strikingly similar as conceivably to raise the question of indebtedness in minds other than his and mine, I suspect that his reaction would be similar to my own. Professor Niemeyer has found in Alexander Solzhenitsyn a writer whose perception of human nature and this world's reality have affinities and resonances with his own. He has quickly intuited that Solzhenitsyn is, if you will pardon the expression, a soul brother. And each succeeding revelation from Solzhenitsyn's pen confirms this early recognition, I'm sure. Not all early admirers of Solzhenitsyn have been so fortunate, as Professor Niemeyer alluded to. A couple of months ago, writing in the New York Times, William Safire announced that he wished to be the first on his block to express misgivings and growing reservations about Solzhenitsyn. For many, misgiving changed to consternation when Solzhenitsyn's letter to the Soviet leaders was made public. Those spokesmen of the liberal establishment in America who rely for their self-definition on the fantasies of being dissenters and who saw in Solzhenitsyn the flesh and blood embodiment of their fantasies, now discovered to their horror that their erstwhile hero advocated authoritarian government for Russia, nationalization of the International Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, a renunciation of Marxist ideology and traditional religion. Further, he called the West, their West, materialistic and morally bankrupt. Such a show of ingratitude for their signed petitions on his behalf. If we need to be, we are aided in understanding Solzhenitsyn's exasperation with our Western liberal intellectuals when we read in the New York Times, alongside an article estimating that the Soviet Union has now more than 1 million prisoners, including 10,000 political prisoners, a commentary entitled, and I quote, "Soviets internal security eased since Stalinist era. Arbitrary repression that Solzhenitsyn described is now much reduced. Facade of legality upheld," end of quote. That was just the title. This is precisely the opposite from the point that Solzhenitsyn has recently made in his Gulag Archipelago, which explained that Soviet terrorism began with Lenin and was not an invention of our convenient whipping boy Stalin, and that the USSR's present leaders are as deeply implicated as Stalin. They would be among the 250,000 from whom he called for confessions. This particular column by a man who should not go unnamed, Hedrick Smith, said such things as, and I quote, "Some Soviet dissenters themselves concede that today there is less of the terrifying arbitrariness of the Stalinist purges." Mr. Smith praises with faint damning, quote, "By Western standards, Soviet justice remains harsh and heavily loaded in favor of the state and its concept of internal security and against the individual," end of quote. Heavily loaded indeed. And brute force and psychological terrorism to the point, as with Pyotr Yakir, of brainwashing and breaking, are mildly characterized as, quote, "its concept of internal security." And where is the facade of legality under which Solzhenitsyn was exiled? Leon Trotsky, the last famous Russian exiled for political reasons, that in 1929, was exiled under a law calling for expulsion from Soviet territory of an enemy of the people, a punishment seen then as harsher than imprisonment, not lighter. That law was repealed in 1958. According to their own laws then, the Soviet authorities had no legal grounds for exiling Solzhenitsyn. As to expulsion, at least, it was Stalin who observed legal technicalities and Brezhnev Kosygin who simply ignored them. Solzhenitsyn has had recent comments about that kind of Western press response to him, particularly the response since his letter to the Soviet authorities. Responses that criticized him, labeled his writings as displaying nationalism, utopianism, and a call to return to the past. And he replied, "In this way, the press is capable of introducing incomprehension between distant parts of the planet rather than internal understanding." His concern throughout much of his writing and most nobly and eloquently stated in his Nobel lecture. Solzhenitsyn's case, I submit, is a perfect example of intellectual blinders being provided by ideological presuppositions. Assuming, as we all do, that virtue resides in our particular ideology, when a man who has the holy smell of virtue happens along, we immediately react by claiming him for our side. Happily, some American liberals seem so far to be resisting the effort to jettison him and to hurl him into the abyss now that his letter has become public. But there will, I predict, be many more blocks than sapphires where the first voice of reservation will be raised. And Solzhenitsyn specialists will one day earn tenure for belittling his power to think while praising his raw courage. If those of the left are embarrassed by their exuberant embrace of Solzhenitsyn, so will be any who wish to claim him for the American right, particularly the libertarian right. Solzhenitsyn is emphatically his own man, and any attempt to politicize him, he will assuredly meet with unremitting resistance. Professor Niemeyer knows this, and that is why he is, in my opinion, in the forefront of American commentators on Solzhenitsyn. Thus, any disagreements that I might have with his paper, disagreements always being more interesting than agreements, as evil is more fascinating than good, do not rise above the level of caveats. They are four. First, I agree that Solzhenitsyn is a great modern writer who restores the image of man as a whole unified being. But is he really the only one? Does not Flannery O'Connor? What of Thornton Wilder or Saul Bellow? And especially, what of Solzhenitsyn's fellow countryman, Mikhail Bulgakov? Perhaps the concept of restoring the image of the whole man is too vague a concept to be used without fuller elaboration than Professor Niemeyer has given. Second, in his lecture, Professor Niemeyer suggested that every character that Solzhenitsyn presents is a whole man. It seems to me not so. Sasha Lenartovich, the young revolutionary student in August 1914, seems to me demonstrably not a whole person and is criticized precisely for the kind of distortion of humanity which his ideology has led him into. The same is true of the party functionary, whose name slips my mind at the moment.
Rusenov?
Yes, thank you. In Cancer Ward.
Rusenov, yeah.
And I think the contrast between him and Kostoglatov is worth being made. Third, oh no, you didn't put that in this talk. I'll take that back. I have only three. Now third. Although there was a brief reference at the end to Solzhenitsyn's Christianity, it did not seem to me to receive the proper emphasis. Perhaps one should not speak about Solzhenitsyn's view of man without explaining wherein it is grounded and precisely what it is. Solzhenitsyn's Christianity provides that groundwork. That Christianity has been apparent in his works from the very beginning, at least to the sympathetic reader. That so many of Solzhenitsyn's readers learned about his Christianity only after he explicitly declared his faith in nonfiction prose indicates that they were not sympathetic readers sharing his basic assumptions about reality. Professor Niemeyer does see the religious foundation of Solzhenitsyn's view of man, as other writings attest, and as he referred to briefly here. It seems to me that is one of the most important things to say about Solzhenitsyn. Now, I want to conclude by a few comments of mine in response to a question that I've been asked a few times while at this conference, and that is, what is the meaning of Solzhenitsyn's exile? What purpose does it serve? what value is there, or is it solely a disservice to Solzhenitsyn? How to interpret the exile? In my opinion, this was a very, very shrewd move on the part of the government. Exile was worse than death in 1929, and it still is, certainly to Solzhenitsyn. What were the other options available? To allow him to go on, to carry on as he had been carrying on, with greater and greater effrontery to the official line, with more and more receptiveness on the part of his fellow countrymen, with wider and wider underground circulation of his manuscripts and his ideas? Would it be to imprison him and to thereby confirm the very things that he had said used to be wrong and still are wrong with the Soviet Union? Would it be to kill him and crown him with martyrdom and make his influence even greater than imprisonment? No, why not send him out of the country, off to the wealth which has accumulated outside the Soviet Union in his name, and thereby tarnish the halo of the sufferer and of the prophet? Furthermore, he is cut off from his own natural community. He is a man who has said throughout, and his writings bear witness of that, that he writes for Russia, and he writes to Russia. He cares little what people outside Russia think about his writings. And how will he be received outside Russia? How will he be received by the American intelligentsia as the years go on? He will, I think, be treated the same as any other writer, not spared the ideological critiques which his position inside the Soviet Union encouraged. The sparing of the critiques was encouraged. I believe he will go on writing. We don't yet know just what manuscripts he was able to bring out with him. He will go on writing, I am sure, and writing to and for Russia. I do have a fear about the future of his writing. In his passion to correct the writing of the history of Russia, I fear that the passion may dilute the literary quality of his writing. Being a driven man, now I think 56 years old, having suffered from cancer, he may write too fast, too facilely. The question in my mind is, can he keep in healthy tension the prophetic urge and the call to produce works of art? Professor Niemeyer suggested that August 1914 and Gulag Archipelago are essentially works in the prophetic mold. I would wonder, I would ask, are they artistically as durable as The First Circle and Cancer Ward? I am assuming here that literature is not for dilettantes. I'm not sure how, let us say, social scientists respond to my assumption. As a literary person, that is a concern that I have. I have my time more than up. Thank you.